Captain Kevin Smith, and this is Throttle Up, a radio show and podcast dedicated to the proposition that critical thinking, when employed, can dramatically improve performance in whatever we are doing, enable us to solve problems that others avoid, equip us to become thought leaders instead of followers, and provide us with the intellectual resources and moral courage to support and defend America and its Constitution. Our motto is clarify, reason, win. That is, clarify the actual, employ analytic reason, and achieve mission success. Our website, throttleupradio.com, that has all kinds of information. Also, our podcast is located there, as well as iTunes. And of course, we have a blog, so please visit our website. Our support staff, Evergroove Studios for audio engineering services. They are located in Evergreen, Colorado, and Reflections Printing for multimedia support, and they are located in St. George, Utah. Our book is Critical Thinking Essentials, Quick Reference Handbook. It is available from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and other outlets. Our broadcast time on Red State Talk Radio, we are on the weekends, both Saturday and Sunday, on the main channel, that's at 7 p.m., and the Encore channel, that's at 6 p.m. Okay, welcome back to another Throttle Up. And this week, we are going to talk about the impeachment debacle. And I know that's sort of like front and center on a lot of people's minds. Certainly, I'm being overwhelmed, I guess, with information about it. It's front page and everything across the board that you can say. It's also, in my perspective, it's unfortunate. It is sad. It is somewhat distressing, too. And also, I will admit that some of it is kind of confusing because I don't actually know how people can think this way, or I guess you could say how people can think a certain way. If we're dealing with mature adults, if we're dealing with educated people, if we're dealing with people that live in a modern industrial society, the question that I have is, or the fundamental question is, how do they come up with this? How do they think? What exactly goes on in their brains? What exactly goes on in their consciousness? How can they actually think this particular way? So, you know, as I prepare this show, I've been thinking about this, and I spend some front end time on, as Rush Limbaugh would say, show prep. Sure, we all do that in various forms. Of course, you know, this show is not necessarily about the headlines. It's not necessarily about the front page of the Wall Street Journal for this particular time and place. Sometimes we sure go there, and that's all right. We tend to be more of a, in-depth, more of a meaningful discussion about issues from the perspective of critical thinking. And that's what we basically what we're all about. So we try to frame the discussion. We try to organize ourselves in a way that more or less focuses on critical thinking and how we can use it to better our lives, how we can use it to improve the lives of ourselves and our people around us, how we can improve the lives of our improve the viability of our organization if we belong to an organization or an enterprise or a unit or a group, whatever, how we can use it beneficially. How can we use critical thinking for the benefit of ourselves and others? How can we do that? And so we frame our discussion from that perspective. So, you know, I was thinking about this, and then it occurred to me that maybe, you know, maybe we ought to try to go back to the beginning or maybe we should try to go back to the beginning and start off by, you know, by considering certain things about the human condition. And I guess that's a good way to think about it. Here we are dealing with the human condition and as it applies to the politics of the day, how it applies to the polarization, the hyper conduct, the extreme levels of anger, the hatred of another person or another group. So let's go back to the beginning. All right. So where am I going with this? Well, what I'm going to be looking at is that from the beginning, we're going to go through this, mental exercise or this journey, if you will. So we go through this journey and we start off at what I think ought to be the beginning. And as we progress through this journey, we learn certain things along the way and we hopefully can clarify certain items that are going on, certain issues that are happening to us in this current time and place, and then see how we can use that to be helpful or to improve ourselves and the lives of others. All right, so the impeachment debacle. And let me say up front that what's going on right now is borderlines on, or maybe they have encroached upon the area of outrageousness and something that is beyond belief. All right. So when I say something is beyond belief, I mean that it is just, you know, in a rational world, if we can think of ourselves as more or less living in a rational world, then how is it or how should we process, how should we think about a situation or a group of people that are acting so irrationally? How should we think about that? And I would say that, you know, from my point of view, I would say that the impeachment managers from the House that have presented their case to the Senate with respect to President Trump and their two articles of impeachment, I would say that they have gone beyond the realm of what is rational. To me, it is completely irrational. They have entered the realm of fantasy, of irrationality. Their articles and their background discussions and their justifications, on and on and on, just simply don't make any sense in a rational world. And I keep going back to Ayn Rand's definition. She said that, said written in her book, that, you know, reality is an objective fact. So what is real? That can be supported in some kind of way that we as human beings use to stay rational, to stay reasonable and effective, and not go completely haywire, not go completely insane. Where is our lifeline to sanity? What is it? Well, I would suggest that our lifeline to sanity is, well, comes from two places. I would say that the first place, and this is something that I do not have a lot of experience in, but I do think it is a great original source. If you're looking for where does my lifeline to sanity, to reality, to effectiveness, where does it come from? The first lifeline I would strongly suggest is the Toltec Book of Wisdom by Dr. Ruiz. It's called the Fourth Agreement, the Four Agreements, and there is a follow-on book that is also called the Fifth Agreement. So I'm a little bit confused here, and forgive me for being so. But it started out, the book title is in fact the Four Agreements. So that's a good place. There is a follow-on book called the Fifth Agreement. So then, for lack of a better term, I will call it the Five Agreements. And what are they? And you can, of course, you can read the book. It's by Dr. Ruiz. Don Miguel Ruiz is his name. He's actually a medical doctor as well as a writer and a thought leader. The Fifth Agreement. And here's where I think, at least for me, it's a very good place to start. The Fifth Agreement is the power of doubt. And it goes on to say that with respect to the power of doubt, we should be skeptical about everything, but we should also be open or be able to learn to listen. Now, when you say when they say learn to listen, it's a little bit more nebulous than listen to someone speak out loud. Also, listen to your inner voice, listen to your conscience, listen to your if you like the term, listen to your spirit guides if you are religious oriented, as I am, certainly. I'm not bashful about saying so. I do believe that there is a spiritual realm to existence, and I think we should acknowledge that and use that to help be helpful. Okay, so it goes on to, it starts off by saying this. The Fifth Agreement is to be skeptical, but learn to listen. Be skeptical because, and here I think is really, really gets to the heart of the matter. And I applaud Dr. Ruiz for this sentence. Be skeptical because most of what you hear isn't true. You know that humans speak with symbols and that symbols aren't the truth. Symbols are only the truth because we agree, not because they are really the truth. But the second half of the agreement is learn to listen. And the reason is simple. When you learn to listen, you understand the meaning of the symbols that people are using. You understand their story and the communication improves a lot. Then perhaps, instead of all the confusion among humans who inhabit the earth, there will be clarity. Okay, so that begins the discussion of the Fifth Agreement, which is the power of doubt, to be skeptical. All right, so he covers a lot of ground here, and it's probably worth covering as well. We're not going to directly be talking about this book, but we probably, and I have done this in the past, certainly. And I don't mind using it because I think it's some really good stuff. All right. So as we dive into this issue concerning the impeachment and the impeachment debacle of President Trump going on right now in the Senate, I'm gonna read two things that sort of like helpful, hopefully gets us up to speed on what exactly is going on and how do these people think that support the impeachment situation. They support more or less, either directly, indirectly, or secretly, hidden under some obfuscation. They more or less support what is going on. And that'll bring us to a better understanding of this from a critical thinking perspective. So there are two, there's a lot of players there. Okay. Lots and lots of players in this field, but there's two that I have, identified, that I think are representative of the group of people that, more or less support this impeachment initiative. Now there's a whole bunch of people out there in the country who do not. As a matter of fact, according to what I have listened to and heard and read and watched, many, many commentators are saying that the American people are not particularly interested in what the political establishment is doing with respect to impeachment. They're just not interested. It's sort of like a gnat, kind of like a bothersome fly that they see this not as central to their lives, nor as anything that's going to have any kind of enduring quality to that be or to be uplifting. And as a matter of fact, a lot of people are more or less disgusted. All right, so that's what I'm getting. All right, and you can make your own decisions about that and draw your own conclusions. I'm not suggesting that you take my word for it. I am suggesting that you investigate it and come to some understanding of what is the general consensus out there among the average voter, not the politician, the average voter. All right, so I have identified two people. And it could be a lot more, and maybe there are better examples. But I do have two people there that are representative of what I would consider to be either directly or indirectly part of the establishment. And these people are members in the public eye, and so they have a public record. One of them happens to be, I'm assuming, now I don't know this for sure. All right, but many of them happens to be a Democrat, or one of them happens to be a Democrat, and one of them happens to be a Republican. But they both support, or they are both either involved directly or indirectly in this initiative to find something wrong with President Trump that is disqualifying in nature, right? They want to identify a disqualifying condition, disqualifying feature, disqualifying attribute, or disqualifying activity. They want to find something that is disqualifying. Now, I can identify a number of people who have attempted to do so publicly. Senator Mitt Romney is one example. Now, these two people, they do have a public record, and I'm going to read a little bit about them before we get into some really quite important audio clips as we go through this discussion, which I have entitled The Impeachment Debacle. The first one is Justice Department Attorney, actually State Department Attorney, Bruce Orr. And this comes from the Inspector General's report on the Crossfire Hurricane investigation that was launched by the FBI. And we have talked about this before. But this is rather a fascinating discussion. So they, as part of this executive summary, they talk about Bruce Orr. Okay, they said that we described the interactions Department Attorney Bruce Orr had with Christopher Steele, the FBI, Glenn Simpson, who is the owner of Fusion GPS, and the State Department during the Crossfire Hurricane investigation. At the time of these interactions, which took place from about July 2016 to May 2017, Orr was the Associate Deputy Attorney General in the Office of the Deputy Attorney General and the Director of the Organized Crime and Drug Enforcement Task Force. Beginning in July 2016, at about the same time that Steele was engaged with the FBI on his election reporting, Steele contacted Orr, who he had known since at least 2007, to discuss information from Steele's election reports. At Steele's suggestion, Orr met in August 2016 with Simpson to discuss Steele's reports. At the time, Orr's wife, Nellie Orr, worked at Fusion GPS as a independent contractor. Orr also met with Simpson in December 2016, at which time Simpson gave Orr a thumb drive containing numerous Steele election reports. That's a Steele dossier that Orr therefore provided to the FBI. In October 18th, after speaking with Steele that morning, Orr met with McCabe to share Steele's and Simpson's information with him. Thereafter, Orr met with members of the Crossfire Hurricane team 13 times between November 21st, 2016 and May 15th, 2017, concerning his contacts with Steele and Simpson. All 13 meetings occurred after the FBI had closed Steele as a confidential human source, and except for the November 21st meeting, each meeting was initiated at Orr's request. It goes on to say that Orr met with the FBI to report on the Steele issues relating to the Steele dossier without his supervisors knowing that he was doing so. Okay, that's all I'm going to say about that situation. But you begin to see here, there was and still is a very concerted effort underway in certain quarters with certain people, and they're very, very well hidden. But there is a concerted effort to undo the last election, to find some kind of disqualifying feature, occurrence, activity, or omission, something that disqualifies Donald Trump from holding public office and being the president of the United States. So they are working day and night to find something. Now, they worked very, very hard to create a completely fallacious document and use it officially in government activities, government proceedings, and as verifiable evidence in which it wasn't. It was all made up. It was all fake. But they used it camouflaged as verifiable evidence. And so, and this concerted effort continues. It continues. And you can see it on full display when you if you can get through it. I know it's painful, but if you listen to the House managers briefing the Senate on why President Trump needs to be impeached. You can see this thing on full display as, you know, almost as we speak. All right. And a couple of things that come right out front is that, okay, what exactly are they trying to say here? What exactly are they trying to prove? What disqualifying situation are they trying to convince us of that justifies the removal of President Trump from office? What is it? And their disqualifying behavior, as it turns out, this is behavioral related. Their disqualifying behavior is Trump acted in contempt of Congress, and the other one is abuse of presidential power. So abuse of office and contempt of so. Those are considered now. The evidence is, you know, it's a little bit, you know, well, it's not a little bit. It's quite hard to take in their efforts, their extreme efforts to convince people like you and me that these offenses are in fact justification for a removal. Okay, the other one is actually a Republican, but it clearly and her name is Peggy Noonan, and she writes an opinion piece in a Wall Street Journal every weekend or most weekends. She clearly is a anti-Trumper. She clearly is not in favor of Donald Trump for various reasons. Some of them are really hard to understand given the state of the economy and the improving conditions for almost all Americans across the board, and how they can ignore that evidence is to me is the most astounding thing about certain aspects of human behavior, or let's say certain cognitive conditions that occur in the minds of people that are able to actually block out evidence, block it out entirely. I mean, there is no, you know, there is, you know, the mind is not open to conflicting evidence. If the evidence conflicts with a cherished, the most cherishedly held belief, then it is immediately ignored or rejected or ridiculed. It's rather a fascinating part of it. All right, so I'm going to read a couple of excerpts there, and then we're going to get right involved in some of the specifics of the impeachment hearings in the Senate. Now, the title of this article is "Impeachment Needs Witnesses on Both Sides." All right, so that's the title of the article. Now you can begin to see, you know, what's going to happen here in what's going to be presented in this article when the article starts off by the impeachment needs witnesses on both sides. Okay, so the first you know, question that comes to, I would suggest, the first question that comes to the mind of a critical thinker would be, okay, were witnesses not allowed to appear? No, they were. All right, there was plenty of witnesses. The House was responsible for bringing in witnesses and interviewing them and documenting their evidence and in all of the hearings that were conducted by the House of Representatives. And we're assuming the fact that the House of Representatives has done a credible job of gathering information in which they have used to justify their articles of impeachment. Now, okay, so here's where a critical thinker begins to see this thing as going, outside the realm of rationality and reality. All right, so we need more witnesses. Why is that? Because those witnesses that we had weren't enough. Time has passed and those witnesses or new witnesses has emerged. Okay, well, at what point in time, you know, do we stop the witness hearing process and then get on with the rest of the proceedings and the rest of the impeachment proceedings, the rest of the case? At what point is that? Where do we, and that, you know, and that was left up, you know, obviously that was left up to the House of Representatives, because the Constitution gives the House of Representatives the sole responsibility to call witnesses and to construct their arguments in favor of impeachment. Okay, but now we need to start this whole thing over again. Okay, so I can see where the title of this article is rather interesting. It's also, frankly, it's also a bit disingenuous, right? Anyway, she starts off by saying, "We must take our satisfaction where we can. It is not terrible for the young that they witness a certain gravity emanating from Congress." Okay, that's rather a strange, it's not. But stopping there, I would say, okay, that's the first two sentences. And why is that being said? It's not terrible. I would say, okay, then how did you arrive at that? It's not terrible. I would kind of think that it is. I mean, this doesn't happen. This is not a daily occurrence. This is an extreme event. This is a crisis that has occurred, possibly leading to a catastrophe, possibly leading to a miscarriage of justice. Is justice impartial here? And is what going on impartial or not? The third sentence, there's a lot to be learned and reminded of when we speak of the genius of the founders and quote Hamilton, Madison, and others as they created the political arrangements by which we live. Oh, that's a constitution. All right. So that's what I'm not sure the point is. They were not shallow men. It's good to be reminded that for all our flaws as a nation and people, we came from something magnificent and are the heirs of that magnificence. Okay, sure. Okay. It is good for the young to see our representatives enact, sometimes actually model, personal dignity. This is really impeachment manager, Representative Joe Logfrin. We're looking at you. It's good to see these hollowed halls actually seem hollowed. And then she goes on. Now this is really amazing. All right. And now here we can start to exercise our critical thinking skills. All right. Now she says in the next few paragraphs, I'm quoting here. Peggy Noonan says, "I believe the president is guilty of shaking down the government of Ukraine for personal political gain, that he has rightly been embarrassed for this, and that the fit final punishment with an election coming was censure, not impeachment. But we are where we are, and the proceedings can be enriched if both parties unclench and let this thing broaden out. The key to deepening things, capturing the essence of the argument, and satisfying the majority of the people is three words: witnesses, witnesses, witnesses. History deserves them. The public wants them, according to polls, and will not be fully served without them." Okay. History deserves them. That's kind of an esoteric argument. The public wants them. I'm not sure what polls she is referring to, but as far as I can tell, the public has lost interest in all of this. All right. But keep this in mind. And this is really important. And this kind of goes to the heart of critically analyzing an argument. Okay. So her argument is plain and simple. As the headline says, your argument is witnesses. Okay, she wants witnesses. Okay, you can say, all right, fair enough. All right, we'll grant you that you want witnesses, but this is not the purpose here. I mean, the time has passed for witnesses. because that was the job of the House of Representatives. The job of the Senate is to not call more witnesses, but to examine the evidence for or and against this kind of extreme action in a deliberative, nonpartisan way. Okay, so witnesses. All right. Well, okay. Let's say for the moment here that we probably maybe ought to have some, or at least I am open to the idea. Let's assume that I'm not saying that I am, but let's assume that I am open to the idea of witnesses. Okay. Now, further on in the article, she talks about Joe Biden, and she talks about calling or the idea that Joe Biden ought to be a witness. Now here she says, all right, now here's where the critical thinking breaks down in her argument. She says here that she asks a question, a rhetorical question. Is it unfair to ask Mr. Biden to testify on his approach to and actions on Ukraine corruption when he was vice president? Is it unfair to ask how he viewed his son's job with the company of a nation on which the senior Mr. Biden held portfolio? No. And it would satisfy half the country. And then she says, good, we're finally talking about swamp and its corruption. So she's open to the idea, or at least appears to be open to the idea, that Joe Biden could and should be called as a witness. Okay. But then she says that Hunter Biden, Joe Biden's son, should not be called as a witness. So right up front, she's calling for witnesses, but then she's qualifying that statement in the body of her argument by excluding, by taking the unilateral action or making the unilateral decision that witnesses should be called, but certain witnesses should not be. Okay, well, that completely breaks all the rules of critical thinking. And you could spend, you know, days and days talking and wondering about this and being outraged and being aghast and being just overwhelmed with complete confusion. How can somebody who is supposed to be a seasoned writer, a national figure, how can somebody write such stuff as that? How can anybody think this way? How can anybody think this way? In my view, and I rarely do this on this show, and I really hesitate to do this because, you know, this show is not about criticizing others. It's not about it. But it does need to address itself to, and it does. This show does address itself to critical thinking, those cases where critical thinking has worked well, and those cases that need more help in the area of critical thinking. And in this situation, I would say that the Peggy Noonan article in the Wall Street Journal, and I'll give you the dates. You can look this up. Saturday and Sunday, January 25 and 26, 2020, page A13. You can look it up. Peggy Noonan's article needs a lot of help with respect to critical thinking because it violates some basic principles, concepts, and precepts that support the understanding, the coherent understanding of what critical thinking is. All right, we're going to take a short break and then we're going to listen to some interesting audio clip. Okay, Jay Sekulow, at the Senate, final day of Trump defense opening arguments. Pretty good. Let's listen to it.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, Majority Leader McConnell, Democratic Leader Schumer, House managers, members of the Senate. What we are involved in here, as we conclude, is perhaps the most solemn of duties under our constitutional framework. The trial of the leader of the free world and the duly elected president of the United States. It is not a game of leaks and unsourced manuscripts. That's politics, unfortunately, and Hamilton put impeachment in the hands of this body, the Senate, precisely and specifically to be above that fray. This is the greatest deliberative body on earth. In our presentation so far, you've now heard from legal scholars from a variety of schools of thought, from a variety of political backgrounds. But they do have a common theme with a dire warning. Danger. 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 To lower the bar of impeachment based on these articles of impeachment would impact the functioning of our constitutional republic and the framework of that constitution for generations. I asked you to put yourself in, quoting Mr. Schiff's, Manager Schiff's statement his father made about putting yourselves in the shoes of someone else, and I said, I'd like you to put your shoes, yourself in the shoes of the president. And I think it's important as we conclude today that we're reminded of that fact. The president of the United States, before he was the president, was under an investigation. It was called Crossfire Hurricane. It was an investigation led by the FBI, the Federal Bureau of Investigation. James Comey eventually told the president a little bit about the investigation and referenced the Steele dossier. James Comey, the then director of the FBI, said it was salacious and unverified. So salacious and unverified that they used it as a basis to obtain FISA warrants. Members, managers here, managers at this table right here, said that any discussions on the abuse from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act utilized to get the FISA warrants from the court were conspiracy theories. I told you at the very beginning, I asked, do you put yourselves in the shoes of not just this president, of any president that would have been under this type of attack? FISA warrants issued on people affiliated with his campaign, American citizens affiliated with people of his campaign. Citizens of the United States being surveilled pursuant to an order that has now been acknowledged by the very court that issued the order that it was based on a fraudulent presentation. In fact, evidence specifically changed by the very FBI lawyer who was in charge of this, changed to such an extent that the Foreign Surveillance Intelligence Court, as I said earlier, I'm not going to repeat it again, issued two orders saying that when this agent, this lawyer, made these misrepresentations to the National Security Division, they also made a misrepresentation to a federal court, the federal court, the Foreign Surveillance Court, a court where there are no defense witnesses, a court where there is no cross-examination. It's a court based on trust. That trust was violated. And then the director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, James Comey, decides he will leak a memo of a conversation he had with the President of the United States. And he is leaking the memo for a purpose, he said. to obtain the appointment of a special counsel. And lo and behold, a special counsel was appointed. And it just so happens that that FBI agent, lawyer, who committed the fraud on the FISA court, became a lawyer for the Mueller investigation, only to be removed because of political animus and bias found by the inspector general. Then we have a special counsel investigation. Lisa Page, Agent Strzok, I'm not going to go into the details. You know them. They're not in controversy, they're uncontroverted. The facts are clear. But does it bother your sense of justice even a little bit? Even a little bit, that Bob Mueller allowed the evidence on the phones of those agents to be wiped clean while there was an investigation going on by the inspector general. Now, if you did it, Manager Schiff, if you did it, Manager Jeffries, if I did that, destroyed evidence, if anyone in this chamber did this, we'd be in serious trouble. Their serious trouble is they get fired. Bob Mueller's explanation for it is, I don't know what happened. I don't know what happened. I can't recall the conversations. You can't view this case in a vacuum. You are being asked, and I say this with the utmost respect, you are being asked to remove an elected, duly elected president of the United States. This isn't some... We had references to law school exams, and I love the fact that I thought were great analysis yesterday, and I appreciate all of that. But I want to focus today, on my section, on what you're being asked to do. You are being asked to remove a duly elected president of the United States, and you're being asked to do it in an election year. In an election year. There are some of you in this chamber right now that would rather be someplace else. And that's why we'll be brief. I understand. You'd rather be someplace else. Why would you rather be someplace else? Because you're running for president, the nomination of your party. I get it. But this is a serious deliberative situation. You're being asked to remove a duly elected president of the United States. That's what the articles of impeachment call for, removal. So we had a special counsel, and we got the report. And just for a moment, putting yourselves in the shoes of this president or any president that would be under this situation, your number four at the Department of Justice, his wife is working for the firm that's doing the opposition research on him and is communicating with the foreign former spy, Christopher Steele, to put together the dossier, and it's being handled by Christopher Steele through Nellie Orr to her husband, then the fourth-ranking member at the Department of Justice, Bruce Orr, and all of this is going on, and he doesn't want to tell, and he's testified to this, he doesn't want to tell everybody what he's doing because he's afraid he might have to stop. Might have to stop. How did this happen? This is the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And then we ask, why is the president concerned about advice he's being given? Put yourself in his shoes. Put yourself in his shoes. We've given you, and our approach has been, to give an overview. And to be very specific, to remove a duly elected president, which is what you're being asked to do, for, in essentially, policy disagreements. You heard a lot about policy. Although the one that it still troubles me. This idea that the president, it was said by several of the managers, is only doing these things for himself. Understanding what is going on in the world today as we're here. They raised it, by the way. I'm not trying to be disrespectful. They raised it. This president is only doing things for himself while the leaders of opposing parties, by the way, at the highest level, to obtain peace in the Middle East, to say you're only doing that for yourself. I think the irony of that those statements were made while all of that was going on. And and other acts that this body's passed, some of it bipartisan, to help the American people. Policy differences. Those policy differences cannot be utilized to destroy the separation of powers. House manager spoke for, I know we've had disagreements on the time, if it was 21 hours or 23 hours. They spoke during their time, a lot of time. Most of it attacking the president, policy decisions. They didn't like what they heard. They didn't like there was a pause on foreign aid. I laid out before that there was pauses on all kinds of foreign aid. It's not the first president to do it. But the one thing I'm still trying to understand from the manager's perspective, and maybe it's not fair to ask the managers because you're not the leader of the House. But remember the whole idea that this was a dire national security threat, a danger to our nation? We had to get this over here right away. It had to be done before Christmas. It was so important. It was so significant. The country was in such jeopardy. The jeopardy was so serious that it had to be done immediately. Let's hold on to the articles of impeachment for a month to see if the House could force the Senate to adopt rules that they wanted, which is not the way the Constitution is set up. But it was such a dire emergency. It was so critical for our nation's national interest that we could hold them for 33 days. Danger, danger, danger. That's politics. As I said, you're being called upon to remove the duly elected president of the United States. That's what these articles of impeachment call for. They never really answer the question of why they thought there was such a national emergency. Maybe they will during questions. I don't know. There was such a national emergency. They never did explain why it was that they waited. They certainly didn't wait to have the proceedings, as my colleagues have laid out. I mean, those proceedings moved in record time. I suspect that we've been here more than the House actually considered the actual articles of impeachment. Is that the way the Constitution is supposed to work? Is that the design of the Constitution? And then the question, of course, came up and yesterday on the whole situation with Burisma and the Bidens and that whole issue. And my colleagues went through that a great deal, and I'm not going to do that. But do we have a, like, are we in a situation, we used to call this in free speech cases like a free speech zone. You could have your free speech activities over here. You can't have them over there. Do we have like a Biden-free zone? I mean, was that what this was? You mention someone or you're concerned about a company and it's now off limits. You can impeach a president of the United States for asking a question. I think we significantly showed the question.
Okay, well, we're out of time. We'll continue discussing this next week. Well, that went fast. So this is a close of another show, another Throttle Up. And before I go, I would like to acknowledge a few people. I'd like to thank my listening audience for being here. And I would like to thank Red State Talk Radio for providing us an opportunity for each and every weekend to put on this radio show that we call Throttle Up. And I would like to thank all of you veterans out there. Thank you for your service. And I would like to thank the families of the veterans. Thank you for supporting this noble cause. And I would like to thank all of you on active duty in the Guard and the Reserve. Thank you for serving this great country of ours. And with that, I would like to say goodbye, and we will see you all again next week.